When someone is hurt in a truck accident, the one question everyone has is, why did this terrible collision happen? To answer that question takes an experienced team of lawyers and experts. Not everyone has this type of experience. At Colombo Law, we are truck injury lawyers. It's what we do every day. When someone is hurt by a truck, Colombo Law is the law firm people call to get answers. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.
This is a CNA podcast.
This is The Heart of the Matter. I'm Jamie Ho. And we're talking about COVID-19 and how all of us around the world are dealing with the virus and, of course, the disease that it causes. Countries around the world are ramping up measures day to day to manage the spread of the disease. And how are we responding differently? And why are we responding so differently? And what else needs to be done to contain it? With me to discuss these questions are Su Li Yang, Infectious Diseases Program Leader and Associate Professor at NUS Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health, and Natasha Howard, also an Associate Professor at the same school. Li Yang and Natasha, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to pose the first question to Li Yang. It's been almost 2 months. It feels like an eternity since the first cases dropped on Singapore. Now, I think it may be useful to take a step back, see where we are in these 2 months in terms of how the cases have evolved, and especially how the Singapore government has approached it. I imagine that people see how Singapore has approached it versus all the news that's coming outside from outside of the country. Situate for us how you see the government deal with it and the country deal with it. Is it sort of roughly where you thought we would be looking back to January, if you could have 2020 foresight and hindsight? And is this still a comfortable position that you think it's under control, and where else can we hope going forward?
Thank you. It does feel like the world has turned upside down in this past 2 months.
Exactly.
We in Singapore have been relatively lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the course of events, somewhere around the end of December, China announced that they had these unusual cases that they traced back to a seafood market,
mm-hmm.
which was in truth a live animal market. And then subsequently, the cases spread around the world. We had our first case on the 23rd of January. And then subsequently, we had community cases and imported cases and changes in terms of how we have managed and lived our lives over the past 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at what's happening around the world, we have been relatively spared. We haven't had the necessity to lock down Singapore the way that Wuhan has done, or Lombardy mm-hmm. has done. And we can still go to our favorite hawker centers.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And to convenience stores as well. And our schools have remained open. And I think this is largely because so far we have managed the number of cases that have occurred by relentless contact tracing and by quarantining the close contacts of those persons who were diagnosed with the infection.
That's the very interesting thing, because people can see how different things are here in Singapore versus elsewhere. And to be honest, just man on the street, he'll see that most countries, when they do react, is usually almost lockdown or close to lockdown, right? You see what happened with Malaysia, and then you see UK and Europe. Natasha, what do you attribute to really the fundamental sort of policy decision at the start that precluded Singapore at the beginning from having to go to that stage? What was it that differentiated us versus, let's say, Malaysia?
I would say, just from somewhat of an outsider's perspective, as I'm still quite new here,
mm-hmm.
that the decision was much more of a proactive one here in terms of, this is serious and we need to immediately take action. And therefore, the actions that were taken could be at a slightly, I would say, gentler level than very, very restrictive measures. So the testing, the stringent contact tracing, quarantining, etc., from very, very early on, I think made a significant difference that then enabled ongoing policy to the decisions to be made slightly more based on the evidence rather than much more reactive. So I would say a number of countries, maybe particularly sort of North America, Europe, where they haven't dealt with anything to this extent, well, nobody has, but they haven't dealt with any major outbreaks in quite some time. And for sort of the person on the street, this was a non-issue because it was happening far, far away until people started getting infected, and then suddenly it became an issue. And I think also for governments, it was much more of a reactive response of, can we ignore this? Do we have to do something? Oh, we have to do something. Oh, my God, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
So there wasn't any sort of proactive approach. There wasn't sort of an immediate, okay, what are the experts telling us to do? How do we deal with this? It was much more kind of, how long can we ignore this and hopefully it won't affect us? We have great health systems, it will be fine, to where we are now, where sort of this reactive need to lock down to try and do something.
I mean, if we look at Italy, for example, that's really quite sad and concerning. But if you look at the timelines that they had to deal with from the first visitors from Wuhan and then the first sort of community case to now, it's actually not that long.
Right.
The question is whether or not the health systems have been set up to be able to react as quickly as they needed to. Of course, I like to believe that Singapore, we are small enough, we are central enough, we are able to manage it so quickly. How much of a role model do you think we are realistically looking at other bigger systems, more disparate regional, state, local level systems? What lessons do you think the Italians or the Spanish or the French or the UK now could take? The outbreak will at some point end. If everyone was to look back public policy-wise, what was the first decision they could have made, knowing that they didn't know that much about the virus? Li Yang, what do you think?
That's a complicated question that you ask. And I would rather not say what kind of role model we have been, because that
precisely
tends to be famous last words.
No, we can't be a role model. Precisely, we can't be a role model because there are certain very specific issues and specific circumstances that we have. But I'm just wondering how far other systems could have reacted, how much more quickly they could have reacted.
So I think it's a function of two things. Number one is preparedness, and number two is luck.
Yeah.
And in terms of preparedness, we had a long runway to prepare because we had SARS in 2003,
yes.
After which Singapore as a whole generally stepped up its game in terms of preparing for such outbreaks, including building a new $900 million building with 330 beds that fortunately exists now that can cater for this surge in cases, and building up the contact tracing team that is able to work with the police so that the contact tracing can be done faster. We have also been lucky in the sense that the early cases that came in, none of them have really triggered off big outbreaks.
Yes.
I mean, South Korea is as prepared as we are because they also had a similar experience in MERS. But what happened in Daegu was just beyond their expectations. So if we had a big super spreader events like these, we would also have been scrambling to cope with the issue. What seems to have happened in Italy and US is that when they first started to see the cases, they didn't act to try and stop the community transmission from happening. And by the time they realized it was happening, there were already many generations of transmissions. So the more they looked, the more cases they found, and their systems tend to become a bit overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So I think moving forward from here, one lesson is to be prepared the way the several Asian countries have been because of our experience with SARS and the build that capability. And then also to think of it as an interlinked world. What happens in one part of the world can certainly come to us very quickly.
One thing, Natasha, that came up in the last week or so from the UK especially was this concept of herd immunity. I'm not sure whether people understand what it meant or what it means. Frame for us the different approaches that governments seem to have sort of weighed up. One talking about how you manage herd community, and one once you try to contain it. What's the difference, and why does each one matter, and what are the pros or cons of each one?
I think it very much depends on your health system. Because there is a massive difference between, say, a relatively small geographic area and a strong, well-funded health system, such as we have here, versus, say, for example, in the U.S., where you have a large geographic area, you don't have the same sort of central health system at all. Whereas, or versus in the U.K., where you have a health system that has been, to some extent, underfunded for the past considerable period of time. And that has a massive effect in terms of government ability to control and also decision making. So, for example, the initial UK government approach was to increase herd immunity, which is essentially let it go through the population so that people would get infected quickly and then be immune because they would post-illness then have a level of immunity, which we assume lasts at least a few months, potentially much longer. We don't yet know, obviously. So the idea was, okay, if everybody just gets it relatively quickly, stays home, recovers at home, then it will save overstretching the health system.
Mm.
Of course, once they looked at it more closely, they realized that that actually didn't work very well because the health system would still become overwhelmed, which is why the approach appears to have now changed to much more stringent social isolation measures, closing down schools and universities, etc. So it's more a matter of what the health system capacity is, whether you want to mitigate, i.e., let a certain number of people become infected and then become immune, therefore increasing the number of people who have that immunity, or you want to suppress and therefore people won't become infected, won't get immunity. Potentially, we can wait for the vaccine for the next 18 months or however long it takes. It's very different approaches depending on money as much as anything.
So now, I mean, another sort of buzzword that's been thrown around besides herd immunity is flattening the curve, right? In terms of spreading out and managing the spread so that your health systems aren't overwhelmed. Question is, when you flatten the curve and versus the much sharper upward curve, at the end of the day, are the areas under the curve the same, Su Liang? In your view, how do you explain, if I'm just a man on the street again, what does it mean to me if you're trying to flatten the curve? Does it mean that also, yes, I may still get it, but I get it later on when the healthcare system can take me on? And what's the difference between me getting it now versus 2 months' time?
Thank you. Yeah. I think that's a very good question.
Yeah.
But to go back to the point about herd immunity, what it really means is that for a pandemic or an outbreak to end, then herd immunity has to be achieved by the population so that if the virus gets introduced, for instance, it can't spread so easily and you'll burn out after a while. And usually we think of herd immunity like 80% of the population has already either contracted the infection or received the vaccine, which also creates a situation of immunity. So that's what we think about when we talk about herd immunity. So flattening the curve or mitigation, suppression, all these are different concepts from herd immunity. But back to your points about flattening the curve, what flattening the curve does is to reduce the speed of spread of the virus such that at any one point, not that many people are infected. And because at the same time we reduce the spread of the virus to people, even if we stretch it out all the way to the end, it will take a long, long time to reach the same numbers of infection as if we were to let the disease run its natural course through the population.
So the bottom line is that at the end of the day, most healthcare systems would expect a certain percentage of their population to get it. The question is how far it spreads so that the healthcare system can take care of it.
Yeah.
And again, then Natasha, does this therefore actually then point to the fact that healthcare systems around the world vary quite significantly in their abilities to deal with things?
Yes, exactly.
And the fact is it has exposed failings.
I think any epidemic exposes failings. I think there's no way avoiding that because there are very different levels of preparedness. There's very different levels of capacity throughout. For example, we're now trying to look at what might happen in Syria, in the region, in case, as we already suspect, there are cases there. And the health system capacity there is severely constrained to non-existent.
Yeah.
So if we look at the spectrum from very highly functioning, well-funded systems to non-functional systems, this is why it's unlikely we'll be able to stop it completely. It's likely to be circulating for a considerable period of time, at least.
I mean, to be fair as well, we do see the WHO every day ramping up its messaging to people to step up. And they've become quite specific in saying Southeast Asia needs to step up, et cetera, et cetera. But not said is how far each of them realistically can step up in terms of their testing, in terms of things like that. How would you assess each country? And I think let's focus on Southeast Asia because it's closer to home. Just on pure testing, where is everyone roughly at? Because you do need to test first before you can take further steps. Liang?
I think there are the high-income, small countries like Singapore that's definitely able to ramp up testing. And then there are the low-income countries in Southeast Asia. And here I'm thinking about Laos, or East Timor, for that matter, for which such testing would be very difficult for them to ramp up and step up. But to take that point a little bit further, we look at epidemics in the context of it being a health problem and a health system problem. But when the epidemic is large enough, as in this case, then it's better to view it as a societal problem rather than a health system or a health problem.
Yeah. So if, and these are our neighbors, if they are in a situation where they do not have the testing capabilities, what are the steps that they can take? It cannot be, is it just, let's just go straight to social distancing. What are the intermediate steps that a healthcare system, which is not as well funded, which is quite disparate and quite widely spread geographically, for example, like Indonesia, what realistically can they do, Natasha?
Well, for example, the approach that's been taken in the UK has been very much based on the fact that there aren't enough testing kits available. Mm-hmm. It's not feasible to test everybody. Yeah. So it's been very much, if you have symptoms, stay home. Mm-hmm. Ideally, quarantining family members too, though again, that's not necessarily feasible and may not be happening, but in principle, that should be happening. Now, schools and universities will be closing again because there's many asymptomatic infections that are causing transmission but aren't necessarily symptomatic, so therefore they're not thinking to social distance or to stay at home. So there are measures such as social distancing, such as not having large events, such as closing down schools and universities, such as social isolation of elderly people or those with additional health risks that can be done even without being able to test. Okay. So again, you will never know the transmission rate, and you will never know how many people are actually cases, but it will at least help to limit the spread.
Mm. I mean, going back to the point that Liang raised about this being actually a really social issue at the end of the day as well, I want to talk about the issue of demographics and how specific countries are spread demographically, because one of the things that people say about Italy is that it's exposed really the problems that they have with a rapidly aging society. Looking at that, therefore, how far does a country's demographics determine the health and public policy perspectives in terms of how they approach this thing? So, for example, you see, as Natasha said, certain countries saying for the elderly, it's really truly isolating as far as you can. And then it raises issues about triage as well. Who do you treat when you do need to treat them? So if you see countries which do have that, what's your advice dealing with it?
I'm not sure we're in a place to advise countries because at the end of the day, it's a very complex calculation to make with regards to the negative impacts of social distancing measures on the economy and on society versus the impacts of the virus spreading through the community. Mm. And I'm not at any point clear how to make such a decision.
Yeah.
But it's also quite clear that countries that, for instance, have limited means to absorb shock in the healthcare system, suddenly they would have to impose social distancing measures and more restrictive measures far faster than countries that may be able to expand testing.
Do you think it's in general, though, a good piece of advice for all elderly people, all with complications or health issues, to really consider extreme social distancing right now, Natasha?
I think, again, as Liang says, it depends very much on the country and the situation. If you are in a country where there isn't the ability to test and trace contacts, you might be more likely to be thinking, okay, how can I best protect myself? Additionally, if you are concerned that perhaps the health system might be overstretched and there might not be a place for you should you become ill, again, you would be wanting to take personal protection measures, so you might be thinking in those terms. But again, it is very hard to say.
Let's talk about China, because as we say, it started there, and the measures that they've taken, and they've gotten to quite an interesting position now where they're getting close to no new sort of domestic cases. Of course, in the beginning, there was some criticism. But on hindsight, do you think they've actually done pretty well considering where they were and the scale of the outbreak and getting it down to this level in these few months, Liang?
I think China has done a fantastic job. At the start, of course, the local authorities were not very transparent with what was going on. And it did take quite some time to get around to the realization that things were getting out of hand. But after that, we can see that their measures have even contained the issue with Wuhan, and they have expanded their healthcare capability by building new hospitals in a way I'm not sure any other country can emulate.
Exactly.
So they have done a good job, and I think their problem is now, what are they going to do to prevent the virus from coming in again?
Yes.
Because it's likely to spread again, should they relax all their precautions?
And yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point, because A, they've done very well, but B, I think most people, and I don't blame most governments, because they are just dealing with the here and now. They don't really think about what's going to happen after. Because once you put all these lockdowns in place, there's also the question of how and when you're going to start tailing off, because you don't want to open the floodgates, so to speak, and let it come back in again. So again, this is an issue which I think the Singapore government has tried to manage, and that's why they've sort of progressively raised measures upwards. And I think they have an eye on the post facto decisions as well. But how do you think governments are going to transition in the time when it comes manageable? And how long is it going to take before governments can actually start thinking about the measures that's going to come in place after the fact, Natasha?
I think this is the key question,
yeah,
isn't it? Because
mm-hmm.
it's quite unclear now what will happen in a few weeks or even a few months in terms of government policies, because a fair amount of it has been sort of reacting and trying to catch up.
Yeah.
And of course, governments are aware that as soon as these measures that they have put in place, as soon as they relax them, then they could again see a significant increase in transmission. So I think this is a question that governments are currently wrestling with in terms of what do they do. And this is where we could look at the potential for relaxing measures once a certain threshold has been released, or ramping up measures once a certain threshold of case numbers have been reached, so as to kind of, again, to spread the epidemic peak and flatten the curve to some extent, rather than saying, okay, we're all done. No more. We haven't had any cases, so we're going to just let things go back to where they were. I don't think that's fully possible, and probably won't be for a considerable period of time. So it's more each country will have to weigh the pros and cons of relaxing for a while and then maybe ramping up again.
Yeah.
So maybe a bit of up and down for
quite
an extended period of time, the foreseeable future, indeed. So it is a very difficult question.
The question really is, how do you prepare the mindsets within the population and the public policy structure for this kind of extended up and downs and extended periods, and keeping everyone and systems, more importantly, at such a high level of alertness? And because it will take a toll on people as well as systems. Is it time for governments to start thinking about the eventuality, Li Yang?
I believe governments and the people have been thinking about it already and are trying to come up with different sorts of solutions for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the new normal that we have to adapt to. And at the same time, we have to realize that what we have been discussing about stepping up and down on interventions like breaks is only possible for certain countries.
Mm.
They have the ability to detect the virus coming in fairly accurately. And that's not going to be possible for many countries in Southeast Asia or Africa, for that matter.
Yeah. To be frank with you, since you mentioned Africa, there are many regions, and Natasha, you mentioned Syria as well. There are many regions out there which are quite concerning as to if it hits them, what's going to happen. So I wonder what role, and honestly, I think there is probably some justifiable criticisms on international cooperation and what the international community is doing as a whole to deal with this situation. Because whether it is now or when you start considering tailing down and removing travel restrictions and things like that, there has to be some coordination, doesn't there? And what role do you think the WHO can realistically play in such a situation, Natasha?
I think the WHO is doing its very best given a very difficult situation, and given the fact that there isn't a global health security watchdog of any kind. I mean, the WHO is kind of cast in this light, but it's not really in a position to play any sort of global police or anything like that. It offers guidance and support. As with Ebola previously, that had far fewer global implications, but a lot of global fear. And again, there was talk then of, okay, what for global health security? We must have better international cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. But it hasn't changed the global architecture significantly. There are changes, but not significantly. It's one of those things that there's pros and cons. If you try and control more globally, then countries lose some of their powers. So I don't think there's a perfect answer.
Mm-hmm. One of the sort of cynical phrases that's been used is that one should never let a good crisis go to waste in terms of the learning lessons that come from them. And to be frank, people have been warning for a long time of this global pandemic. And what's interesting is you've seen China step up. They've done a good job. But you see now, instead of the usual suspects in terms of the less developed healthcare systems, now you have quite developed healthcare systems in developed countries not being able to deal with it. And looking at it globally, therefore, is quite disconcerting when you realize that even the more developed healthcare systems can't deal with it or haven't drawn the right lessons from SARS, for example, or even MERS. What to them do you think should be the main lesson and learning point, Yang?
Wow, that's a big question. I think as with every major outbreak that's happened, the world has become better prepared. Mm. Whether it's SARS in 2003, Ebola in 2014, or the other ones that have come up. And as we have said from the beginning, it's impossible to be perfect and to handle each one perfectly. But I think we will be more prepared globally for the next one. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, stretching back to history, and you look at the number of deaths that this outbreak is likely to cause, it's not going to be as great as the influenza pandemic in 1918, for
Spanish
instance.
Flu,
or even the great plagues that happened before. It's just that we feel that in our current state of technological advance, it shouldn't happen to us.
Okay.
That's why we feel that there's such a sense of loss.
Maybe a perception.
So maybe a final question for each of you, both for Singapore as well as some of the key points, for example, Italy and France maybe. What's a best case scenario? I know people are sort of projecting to worst case scenarios or even just talking about the sheer uncertainty of it all. But if you want to talk about what is a best case scenario in terms of where we can get, if the world and healthcare systems get their act together, what is a credible best case scenario that sees perhaps, as you say, COVID-19 being sort of endemic in most places? What's a best case scenario? Maybe you first, Natasha.
I think probably best case globally is going to be that sort of low-level endemicity. Maybe that's not best case, but maybe most likely as I see it, given the fact that we do have to be somewhat pragmatic. There are some health systems that can't cope. There are some that won't cope. And there are some that will do very well. But then again, they will potentially reintroduce infections once restrictions are relaxed. So pragmatically, I think it's about sort of long-term, low-level.
Will it be a bit
so it can be controlled?
A bit like H1N1, where vast majorities of seasonal flu cases might be H1N1. Is that what we're looking at?
Potentially.
Liang, what's your take?
I think there are two ways to answer this question. I think one is the immediate pandemic, where the best case scenario would be like China, right? Many parts of the world are like Wuhan now, like France or Italy. And you're able to contain it by the significant loss of life and infection and massive social restrictions. And then other parts of China are relatively spared but on a higher alert for re-entry of the virus. The other best case scenario is that we develop a vaccine that is both effective and safe, in which case then it's likely that this coronavirus may become like measles, or it won't be like smallpox, but like measles and other diseases where you are able to protect a large proportion of the population.
The protection,
Yes.
I think we need it on that slightly positive note. Natasha and Liang, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been The Heart of the Matter, and it's available on the CNA website and app under the podcast tab. Till next week, I'm Jamie Ho. Behind me, my team, Lin Su Ling, Crispina Robert, and Erin Low. Natasha Liang, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A world of wonder awaits at Nemacolin. The Grand Lodge will surprise and delight with 56 stunning suites and 5-star butler services. Indulge in libations at the Circle Bar and Study before you savor the new and enchanting Fawn and Fable restaurant, where the best parts of a traditional steakhouse and a fairy tale castle create a magical dining experience. With fine dining, a spa, and over 100 adventures, golf, art, and wildlife experiences, whatever your imagination holds, Nemacolin has the key. Visit nemacolin.com for more information.